Well, thank you very much. This is very strange. This is just for the internet. Yes, I see. Okay. So let's see. I think we don't have to take these slides very seriously, but they just in case we. Are those showing up there? Yes, they are. So what we want to do is we want to view show, right? Okay. So now, I guess I don't have to urge you to interrupt me every sentence or two, because I hope you do, because I have no idea what the general level of background and so on and so forth is. So, I must say, I'm so overstuffed with what I'm about to talk about that it's, because I'm writing a book on this with a friend, and so it's hard to have an objective, cool account, you know what I mean, when you get all involved in this stuff. So here's the point. If what I'm about to say, to the extent that what I'm about to say has validity, it certainly has some validity, and to the extent that it does, these ideas, which are really very simple and which are, in a sense, widely known, should affect one's thinking about a lot of big problems. And I've just listed a few things here just to remind myself. So, for example, the first issue is evolution. So what do I mean by that? Well, when we started to write this a year ago or two, we wondered, dare we make the following statement? And now, of course, everybody says what I'm about to say, whether it's true or not, everyone believes it. And you'll hear a lot more about this from Eric Davidson, I think. And that is that a huge driving force in evolution is determined by changes in gene regulation. So that is to say, the difference between a human and a mouse is not that we may have no genes different from a mouse, not even regulatory genes. The only point is that those regulatory genes, the regulators, are used in different combinations and at different times and so on to express the same genes but in a different pattern. And in fact, the extreme view, which Eric holds, and you can read this in his book, is that essentially all bilaterally symmetric animals have the same genes. There may be a few more of a given family and so on and so forth, but that from the time of the Cambrian, whatever that is, happened a long time ago, that's when there was this huge explosion. I feel safe talking about the Cambrian to a bunch of physicists. Right, better be careful. Somebody may know something. It was more than several weeks ago, right? Was it, or 551 million? Plus one? So here's the way to think about it. As of the Cambrian, you know, when there was this huge explosion thing, the hard thing was getting there, getting to a cell and in these organisms. Once you got there, evolution just went as fast as it could be, because all it had to do was change regulation. Now, the genomes, well, so one would like to know, first of all, is that true? And it's certainly going to be true to a large extent. But the second question is, what then, if it is true, what is the underlying mechanism of regulation, if I can put it very broadly, that enables the system to be so evolvable, that is, to throw up new variants so readily, so that a small number of signals, external signals working through a small number of regulators, can be used in various combinations with a small number of genes to give you all these different organisms. Now, just let's not be confused about something. There's a profound biological problem to which there is probably never going to be an answer, which is not what I mean by this question. And that is, why does it happen that when you express genes in different combinations, you get different things out? You get feet versus hands versus, I mean, that's the mystery of chemistry, and that will have its own explanation for each particular case. But what I'm asking is, what is the nature of the regulatory system itself that allows these combinations to, okay, is that clear? All right, so obviously the same problem occurs in development, right? You have the same genes, and in fact the same regulators are being used, say, to make a hand as to make a foot. It's not like there are special genes for hands and special genes for feet. Yeah, okay. So what is it about the system that enables this to work so readily? And that someone, a guy named Fickett, I don't know who he is, but I just saw, the way he put it was, there's something called a syntax problem. If you look at genes that are turned on, say, in a human, at a particular time and place in human muscle development, and you just look at the binding sites for regulatory factors upstream, you all know what I mean by that? Yeah? They bear absolutely, or they need bear no relation to one another. There's no general, in general, there is no connection between the identity of the regulators and the identity of the genes being activated, or even the times that they're activated. It's as though this is, right? It's as though it's different mixtures of these activators can come together, or regulators, and depending on the combination, work here, work there, so on. So that's another thing we should want to just keep in the back of one's mind. Okay, but maybe going from those very broad problems to putting the matter very at the other end of the scale, and that is to ask about the nature of enzyme specificity, because I think that's what lies at the heart of. By the way, there's another very interesting point I just learned. Let me just say this in passing, because I just learned this, and I think it's quite an amazing fact, that in the yeast genome, there are 6,000 genes. Of those 6,000, if you start eliminating one at a time, it seems that there are only 2,000 that are required to make a yeast. Now, of that 6,000, there are 200 regulatory genes. But of those regulatory genes, only about 10 are required for life. So in a sense, all this, it could be, I mean, I don't know, nobody's really, but it could be that all of the, it could be that although the entire field has been driven since Jacob and Monod in the 1950s and 60s, about studying regulation, we should just keep in mind that regulation may be what distinguishes us from yeast, but the basic matter of making a cell may have nothing to do with these regulators, which is either trivializes them or makes them more important. I don't know.
This example is described for yeast is under very benign conditions?
Yes, this is under very rich conditions, yes. And I don't even know how well the fact is really known, but I just heard it anecdotally from, yes, have you heard this, Brent?
Didn't know that the pan-European knocking out of yeast effort to determine the mineral yeast had gotten that far.
Well.
So I hadn't heard that.
Okay, now, so the question is, let's now put all that aside and go to the other end of the scale and talk about enzyme specificity. So the, and here there's a problem if you're an outsider, probably more of a problem if you're an insider, unless you're young. Because the terminology that was built around regulation was actually built around a view of the world that has to do with enzymes that are quite different from the ones we're most interested in. So what do I mean by that? The enzymes that direct intermediary metabolism, for example. Everyone knows what I mean by that? Yes. Or for example, beta-galactosidase, the famous enzyme that splits lactose. Or any of these enzymes that work on small molecules have the characteristic that they work on a unique substrate. So for example, if you give an enzyme that's going to metabolize lactose, it's perfectly clear only lactose can fit into that active site. And if you give it glucose, it just doesn't happen to many factors of 10. So the enzymes recognize a unique site, and regulation consists of telling the enzyme whether or not to work, which is done allosterically. Does everyone know what I mean by that? Right. So the classical enzyme, if this is really important, if it's...
Maybe I
better tell you. Okay. So one of the two or three really profound ideas, another idea, in fact, in this case, it came from Jacob and Monod, is that the way you can link any extra signal to any activity of an enzyme is by the phenomenon they called allostery. Allostery means other site. And so let's say you have an enzyme that works on lactose. It so happens that's not a good example, so we need some other examples. But we'll make one up. Something involved in intermediate metabolism, glycogen something or other. Now you can make that enzyme recognize the substrate or not by introducing a site separate from the active site. And it will bind whatever you want, copper or another sugar, some other small molecule, which will cause it in ways that are, will cause it to either become more active or less active. So for example, it might freeze the enzyme, and frozen enzymes can't work enzymatically. Or it might, in the classical case, it might change the arrangement of the subunits so that the active site is no longer present. Actually, allostery was unfortunately first employed to describe hemoglobin. You know, with hemoglobin, you add one oxygen, now the thing changes its shape so that it's easier to bind the second oxygen, and then it's easier so you get a sigmoid binding of oxygen to the hemoglobin. But the general point is that by the proper protein design, since where the allosteric effector is working has no relationship to the active site, you can have any external signal affect any enzymatic activity. Is that clear? I mean, this is a profoundly, it's one of the few really important ideas in molecular biology, in biochemistry, let's say. And so all these systems that work by feedback inhibition and so on, where you have a series of enzymes making a product, the product now feeds back when you get enough of it and turns off the enzyme, that's all working by allostery, because the end product of a series of reactions looks nothing like the thing that the first enzyme is working on, but it can feed back, bind to that enzyme, and turn it off.
How big is that effect, say, binding affinity to the substrate with or without the, how many order of magnitude?
I don't know.
Several.
I guess it just depends on how tightly the thing binds, right? And it's easy to get a couple of kilocalories. That's all you need to get a couple of orders of magnitude.
The kilocalories don't come from binding of the allostery. They come from the internal strain within the protein that the allosteric ligand only serves as a trigger for. So there are two conformations can switch from one to another.
But can you get more? You can't get more of an effect than the binding constant of the ligand to the enzyme, can you? If the ligand binds with 2 kilocalories, you can't get more than that out from the. If there's hysteresis or something. Only if it's irreversible.
No, it has to do with the fact that the binding energy is the exact configuration in space. Changing that configuration to make for better binding has nothing to do with the energetics of binding on the other side. We can discuss this afterwards.
I see. So as long as the thing is bound, it can have an essentially all or none effect. Right. I see what you mean. Yes.
Forgetting about the RNA conformations,
yes.
RNA conformations can be different in any amount of energy, irrespective of the difference of the binding constant that they display for the ligand. So there are two different, absolutely independent quantities here.
Well, okay, we'll talk about it. But anyway, it's certainly biologically significant. And by the way, this is one of the first rules of...
Maybe what I just added, is connected is the difference in energy between the RNA and the binding energy of the allosteric ligand. The allosteric ligand cannot change the RNP configuration by more than its binding energy.
Ah, yes, okay.
Energy invested.
But yes.
The energy binding of the ligand that probes this change of point to R.
Oh, okay. Right, okay, got it. But by the way, might as well just, in the interest of insulting as many people as possible, one reason chemists can't do molecular biologists, and there are no chemists here, are there? Cannot do molecular biology, I mean, at this, in terms of understanding how these things work, is that all the effects ultimately come down to factors of 10, which are incredibly small effects. If you're a chemist, a factor of 10 isn't worth talking about, it's one hydrogen bond. But in case I forget to mention it, as we go through some of these things, every time you see a system where I say it's on or it's off or it's this or it's that, you're basically talking a factor of 10, maybe 100. And these have huge biological effects. Very often they're added because of cooperativity, but, okay?
This group likes it.
This group probably likes this, right, because it shows what low sorts the chemists are. Okay. And actually, if you're interested, in case you didn't know this, the only way anything is figured out, for those of you who know about lambda, the only way it was possible to figure out lambda was by combining genetics with biochemistry. So in other words, people, you know, the youth of today, benighted as they are, there's this hysterical urge to open cells and look at what they see. You do that, you're never going to figure anything out. Because the issue is whether something's binding or not, which to this site versus this site, that difference can be a factor of 10, which is something that's affected by concentration, of course, and you'd never know whether what you see is biologically relevant. You only know when you have a mutant and then can put the thing together in some kind of coherent whole. There are very few cases in biology even now where you can do that. Certainly most cases in higher organisms you can't. But that's why yeast now have proved to be so powerful, because you can make mutants, and so on. So that's just a general thing. Okay, so my general point is that enzymes, the word regulation was invented to describe the allosteric effects of one small molecule on another, an extremely important thing, but it dealt with enzymes as represented by the classical enzymes that recognize single substrates. Now, the interesting thing that's never been explicitly stated is that in molecular biology, regulation deals with enzymes like polymerases, kinases, phosphatases, ubiquitinating machines, splicing enzymes, anti-terminators. Every single one of these enzymes has multiple possible substrates. And regulation consists sometimes of turning the enzyme on and off, but more profoundly of substrate choice. The word has just simply a different meaning. Instead of, already I'm getting ahead of myself, but just so you get the idea. Instead of nature having taken the time to evolve a lot of very specific enzymes, which it might have, and it's an interesting discussion that I'd like to know whether modern engineering and information theory would say you could do this and make a more elegant system. Instead of doing that, nature uses enzymes whose active sites are really quite non-specific and imposes specificity by the regulatory process, which is what I'm about to talk about. So you see, this is what I'm about to tell you is the whole secret to life. Now, why do I have the courage to tell you that? So I was greatly heartened when I read this. See, guys like Brent have a problem. Okay, enough said. Even the Chinese guys, you know, with little names like Wan, Wu, Mu, but Lipschlumblblblr and Potashne and so on. we don't have to worry. Okay, so here's what you generally see in contrast to the classical case. You have an enzyme like, for example, assume that's RNA polymerase. And again, you'll just have to tell me if I say something that you don't know about. And it's in E. coli. So E. coli has 2,000 genes. All of those genes are read by RNA polymerase, although it comes in a couple of different forms. But the most popular form can recognize almost all of the 2,000 genes. So the regulatory problem is, how do you get it to work on the right substrate at the right time and not work on the wrong substrate at the wrong time? The substrate in this case meaning the gene. So what I'm going to do is take you through the arguments. See, we know most, in fact, maybe we know too much about transcriptional regulation. By transcriptional regulation, I mean only whether the decision is made to transcribe a given gene. There are other ways of controlling genes by controlling what happens to their messenger and so on and so forth. But let's talk just about the very simple question of whether polymerase is going to start to transcribe a gene. This is a problem that starts with bacteria, it goes through yeast, it goes into higher organisms. The enzyme that's involved looks very similar in all these organisms. And we know a vast amount. And as I say, I think we know too much, because as soon as you get guys like physical chemists and so on doing experiments, there's always something that is there to confuse you. And, you know, a little bit of information is great. You think you know the answer. Someone can always give you an experiment that says, that can't be the answer. And in fact, the argument I'm about to make could have been made many, many years ago, but we always had these problems, some of which I'll allude to. There are complexities that strike me as, in fact, let me just say, the word accidental. So I just want you to, a creationist would say that every fact about the world is equally interesting because God made it that way, right? Molecular biologists generally are like that. How many times have you heard a molecular biologist say, my system is unique and it's exquisite, and they use all these words? It completely disgusts me. But it's, of course, it's wise for them to do it because that's how you get grants. I've got this thing and so on. But in fact, it's perfectly reasonable that once nature has hit on a crude way of a way of getting something to work, there will be certain molecular interactions that will happen that will be selected for, and then there will be aspects to the interactions that are accidental. And the problem is to figure out, if you want to have any kind of coherent view, what's accidental and what's... just to give you an example, you have already talked about how proteins recognize DNA. So now I'm going to say, in case you don't know it, the function that's selected when a protein binds to DNA is a positional one. That is to say, a regulator binds to DNA, and the reason it binds to that site, what that selection is for, is to position something on the protein to interact with a gene nearby, or with a protein binding to a gene nearby. It's a positional effect. The details of how the protein recognizes the DNA are not important. They might have been important. There might have been a theory of the world which said, well, you recognize DNA in a very special way and change its conformation and so on and so forth, and that changed conformation somehow mysteriously, and there was there have been various sort of plagues like zDNA and so on that you may have heard about. But we've known for a long time that that's just simply not true. And maybe we'll even say... So if it should happen that when the protein binds DNA, in that particular case, the DNA, say, bends a bit, or some of the bases adjust their conformation in the middle and twist a bit, all that, that's what's called interesting. That's the kind of stuff that gets published, because you can do the worst are the X-ray crystallographers, right? Because everything every time you make an X-ray, you make a structure determination, you find complexity. Is anyone surprised that when you put two proteins together, you find all this stuff? Or that when you put a protein on DNA, in some cases, the DNA remains absolutely rigid and like bDNA, and you just stick two alpha helices in the major group, and you're done. That's considered uninteresting. What's really interesting is when the DNA undergoes these subtle conformations. And in fact, Steve Harrison and I, until finally I couldn't understand it anymore, published all kinds of papers about how 434 repressor recognizes DNA. I still don't think it really is quite coherent. Point is, doesn't matter. Those are accidental differences. Nature didn't select for exactly what happens when these... Is that idea clear? So now, of course, someone could say, you're wrong. You've missed the big point. You've missed the point in this case. And how can you be so arrogant as to say it's accidental? Well, that's what's called trying to make a view of the world. But I'm just saying, if you don't adopt that point of view, if you don't take the point of view that the only ultimate explanation in biology is evolution in the sense of what function was selected, then there's just madness, or what's called modern science. You get just stuff, and And the more complicated, the better, because the more interesting. This is really it's a deep psychological, psychiatric problem of humans that you know. Nietzsche talked a lot about this. That there's some other world that's got to be better than the crude world we're faced with. And you know, the other world is things are moving and bulging, and somehow it can't be something straightforward. Anyway, you sort of get my prejudices about this, maybe. Okay. So the problem is where was I? Is substrate selection, and we have to figure out what the essentials of that are. Now, bacteria show us three ways to do this, and I'm slightly hesitant about going through this, but let's try it. So in the first case. So here is before I get into that, here is to show you how, you see, in bacteria, we have just a polymerase that has to get to the gene to transcribe it in its simplest case. When we get to higher organisms, there's this fantastic, even in yeast, the polymerase has 13 subunits, there are all these things. There's this mediator and so on and so forth, there are all these enzymes that modify nucleosomes, you might have heard. We can talk about all this junk. There's just a huge amount of stuff. And so the regulatory problem, just to make this clear, because this is often a matter of deep confusion, the issue is, from the point of view of this discussion, not what all these various enzymes and so on and so forth do, although that's sort of fun. The issue is where they do it. And where they do it, meaning which gene they do it at, that's the regulatory problem. It's a very narrow question. And these regulators turn out to be very simple guys who do very simple things. That's what I'm gonna tell you. And it had to be that way or the system couldn't have evolved. So now let's take one of the three ways that you can do substrate selection as shown to us by bacteria. And these models turn out to be very important because there's one that's going to be used most generally, but the others make experimental predictions that you can then use to test in higher organisms to see if they apply or don't apply. So let's imagine you have polymerase binding to a certain set of genes. And now what the way you select turning on gene 2 is by allosterically converting the enzyme from an inactive form to an active form. This happens. So there's a special form of RNA polymerase in E. coli, which has a certain subunit called sigma 54, which enables it to bind to about 2% of the genes in E. coli, mostly involved in nitrogen metabolism. And the polymerase binds in such a way to make an irreversible complex. It's can be tight as a rock and absolutely nothing happens. Now, the way you activate a given gene is literally by activating the enzyme. So an activator, which bears an enzymatically active site, binds by virtue of its DNA binding address near on gene 2, that thing interacts with polymerase in a very special way to change its conformation, and that gene 2 gets activated. If you wanted to activate gene 1, you would take this machine, put a DNA binding domain so that it would recognize A, and now it would activate that enzyme and turn on gene 1. So, what's perhaps most interesting, well, okay, let's just go on. The other way that is, again, I'm going to say that these two first ways are evolutionary dead ends, so you don't have to be too concerned about them, but the second way is to have the enzyme bind to a set of genes, called substrates, where the genes are in an odd conformation so they don't work, and then allosterically change the gene. This now is a different form of the enzyme. It has a different kind of sigma subunit. So it does this, and in fact, in bacteria, there are a series of genes involved in metal poison elimination. So for example, the polymerase will bind with this thing called MER-R and again form an absolutely ironclad complex that's dead. And the reason it doesn't start transcribing is that the exact positioning of the elements in the DNA are at the wrong twist. And now, when the signal comes, which happens to be mercury, it works on that regulator to twist the DNA, so now it works again. So you can either... So the first thing to remember is that we have a form of the enzyme that recognizes a special set of genes, but is inactive, and the problem is to activate that particular enzyme on that particular gene. The second case, the enzyme is active, but the subunit, the substrate is inactive, and your problem is to activate the right substrate. Now, these are really quite fancy ways of doing things. There's a third way, which is the crude way to do it, which we call regulated recruitment or mass action. In this case, the enzyme is constitutively active, and the gene is active, and the only question is getting the enzyme to the gene, to the right gene. The way you influence whether that happens is several, but one is to use what's called an activator. The activator is something that has a DNA binding address so that it'll bind here and not somewhere else, and then here it has a bit of glue that can touch anywhere on the polymerase to bring the polymerase to the gene. In this way of thinking about things, all that an activator is doing is increasing the frequency with which something happens spontaneously. Neither the gene nor the polymerase is being activated. So the whole idea of calling this process gene activation is bewildering, and in fact, I was saying earlier to Terry, you know, biology is always disillusioning. Everybody who goes into biology thinks that they're going to find something, even if it's either it's articulated as with, you know, those early guys, the physicists who went in about the gene, or it's people like studying development who thought there would be some mystical things and so on and so forth. And it always turns out that it's something cruder than that. So for years and years, I was obsessed by this kind of about gene activation. And it turns out that it's a bit of a hoax. You see, for these genes, which turn out to be the most important genes in coli, and I'm going to tell you for genes in higher organisms, the only issue is to take a very crude system, which works spontaneously at a certain level, and increase the rate at which it occurs by using these locators, as I might call them. And the specificity of the effect is just determined by where this thing binds on DNA. That's what I mean by saying that DNA binding is a address function. It brings to one gene versus another this little bit of glue here called an activating region, which touches the polymerase and brings it to the DNA. Absolutely. The specificity of the system comes from this binding, right? Coupled with actually the affinity of polymerase for the promoter sequence. So this is an example of cooperative binding. Now, I can tell you, I've been talking about this when we figured it out in Lambda for about whatever it's been, 25 or 30 years. Many, many molecular biologists do not understand cooperative binding. I know because I talk to them and I'm astounded at what... But for you, it's probably completely transparent, but maybe I'll just say it. This kind of cooperativity lies at the heart of a huge amount of regulation, both of genes and of other things. And the important thing to remember, how do you do this? And forgive me if this is baby talk, but just so we understand this. Imagine you have two sites on DNA, A and B. Now imagine you have protein A in the cell, and it is not, when you take a snapshot, bound to A. Imagine you have protein B in the cell, and it's not bound to DNA. Imagine you have A and B in the cell. They're bound. And if the DNA in between can loop out if necessary. This cooperativity requires no conformational changes, and it requires no energy. And the reason this is so confusing, I guess, is because cooperativity was, the word implies to people what happens in that hemoglobin model I gave you, right? You add one oxygen to hemoglobin, it changes its conformation, now it makes it easier to bind another, and so on. But although that kind of thing can happen, the essential thing that must happen, and that usually happens as far as we know, has nothing to do with that. It has simply to do with the fact that they touch one another. No. No. The question is, under what conditions are A and B bound to the DNA? And the answer is, B will bind only in the presence of A, and A will bind only in the presence of B, provided they touch one another, and provided one other very critical thing, and that is that the concentrations be low enough so that they depend on one another, right? So this is, again, one of the reasons that, for example, if any of you know anything about lambda, the interactions between the molecules that determine this cooperativity are extremely small in energetic terms, let's say a kilocalorie or two. So the concentration of the molecules, if they were just to rise a factor of 10, this whole thing would occur spontaneously. If you just raised the concentration of A a factor of 10, it wouldn't need B. So I this suddenly dawned, I was giving this talk in New Mexico, some talk in New Mexico recently, at Albuquerque, and some guy there said, my God, I just realized that life depends on the incredible coincidence that the concentrations of things are kept below a certain level. But it's not a coincidence. What you find is, and this is one of the complexities of life, so let me step back again. Viewing the world this way, I claim, clues you in on the nature of many of the complexities that are otherwise inexplicable. And one of the complexities of life is that everywhere you turn, nature is standing on her head, so to speak, to keep the concentration of relevant regulators and other molecules low. Lambda shows you a particular way to do it. We'll see in higher organisms in general, the activators that bind to DNA are kept out in the cytoplasm below, and then they're degraded and so on. So there's a huge armamentarium devoted just to keeping the concentrations of things right. And when, in fact, in every signal transduction pathway we know about, there are mutants that simply by causing a transcription factor at the end of the pathway to be overactive, to increase its concentration, they cause tumors. And in signal transduction pathways and in gene regulation and so on, you overproduce a protein and all hell breaks loose. Now, someone says, but that's not always true. Yeah, of course it's not always true because nature has done all these things to guard against it, try to break it down and so on. But when you finally do manage to increase the concentration, you get these effects. And that's because so much... See, look, you can already see... It should be intuitively obvious. When you go from a lower organism to a higher organism, what you're doing is making events dependent on integrating multiple signals. You want something to happen only if two or three set of instructions are given. Right? So that means that a gene will get turned on a certain part of the organism only when three signals impinge there. So you can use the same regulators they used elsewhere, but if they worked, so that's going to happen if, say, A, B, and C, if their binding depends on one another. Now this is so elementary that it's hard for some people, for ordinary people to understand, and then they think it's somehow not interesting. If I were to tell you, you know, that when A interacts with B, there's this wonderful conformation change so that B now exposes something, that sounds interesting. But the fact is that a lot of it doesn't happen that way, and it just happens this way. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Yes. Yes. Yes, that's exactly right. It's hard to believe that something this crude could work. That's why I tell my friends the problem isn't aging, the problem is that it works in the first place. So for example, well, we can, you know, I'll show you a case. The best studied case is at the interferon enhancer in the human beta interferon gene, where there are three activators. One is called Jun, one is called something funny like IRF37, and one is called NF-kappa-B. So now these things bind highly cooperatively with a little accessory protein to make an enhancersome only when all three signals come like this. But everybody knows each of these proteins also works on a lot of other genes. But when you turn on the interferon gene, you don't turn on the other genes. Because, for example, NF-kappa-B will bind only if helped with these other guys, where NF-kappa-B works at a different gene, unless those guys are also present. You see? And so the way this... Sorry? Well, they help. I mean, they're non-specific, called HMG proteins.
No.
Sorry?
The other should be no. The story you're telling does not depend on the big one. It depends on having the conjunction of the three big ones.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I'm just not sure that these little guys don't... They may decrease the actual energy of interaction you need here, because they're adding energy by... You see, they're just making the thing more cooperative. Yeah. Yes. That's right. But, no. Look, okay, so over at this other case, NF-kappa-B is going to be interacting with X and Y. Okay? Now, the concentration of NF-kappa-B, when the signal comes, increases to the point where, if this is present and this is present, they will bind cooperatively, make an enhancersome. But over here, because X and Y have not made their appearance, they require different signals. Okay? If all are present, yes. That's right. That's right. Okay, so this is now getting a little bit ahead of my story, but that's okay, because I mean the ideas are not that deep, and most of the arguments are with my colleagues, not with people who actually are prepared to think rationally about this. One of the tip-offs, you see, look, this thing forms this wonderful, this is why I say structural biology is, just be suspicious of any expert in biology in any field, because they all have an axe to grind. So, all right, so if this thing forms and it makes this wonderful thing called an enhancersome. So everyone, you know, says, isn't that incredible? You've got this thing, and look at the hydrogen, this bond, and so on. Now, of course, the thing is going to make us, in order for things to bind cooperatively, they've got to touch each other. And so, of course, the thing's going to make a structure. But the question is, does the structure do something special, or is it simply a result of their having bound cooperatively? So for example, a car engine is a special structure. You take the carburetor out, it doesn't work. You put 100 carburetors alone, it doesn't work. But in this case, if you were to take multiple NF-kappa-B sites, for example, now that will activate the gene too. There's an argument that maybe the enhancersome works a little better, that maybe evolution has added some special thing, but it's on the margin. The simple fact, undisputed, is that any one of these things will activate a gene perfectly well. And that's because activators are doing very stupid things. All they're doing is touching the machinery and recruiting it. Now think about the first two examples I gave you, the really sophisticated examples, where you have to change the conformation of the enzyme or change the conformation of the DNA. This wouldn't be true, because you'd have to do, there's only one thing you can do, and it's a very specialized function. Whereas here, you have, in fact, in principle, two forms of cooperativity. First, there's the cooperativity getting them on there, and secondly, they can all touch, right? So they can all add their binding energy, which is, let's see, I was going to, Whoops, yeah. So for example, in theory, if you had two, and in fact, I mean, all this stuff has been demonstrated, if you have two activators that are bound to DNA, even if they're not touching each other, they work cooperatively, right? Because all you're doing is just adding, bringing in the machinery. Whereas in the more sophisticated models, that wouldn't be possible. So there actually are two forms of cooperativity. One is in the binding to make the enhancersome, and secondly, the independent interaction of these guys with the machinery. Yeah.
Is there a general relationship between the binding community of the original package and the photoresistance among themselves? So, in other words, there's a factor that has a binding energy.
Well, it has to be. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and in general, especially in higher eukaryotes, very often the single guys bind extremely, you know, this idea of going around and looking for binding sites in the genome is ridiculous because in fact, you want to make the thing dependent on. Right, now there's a slightly deeper issue, if you want to go back and read about it, in Genetic Switch, there's an appendix that points out that it's very difficult, actually, to make a single thing, although you wouldn't want to do it for the reasons I've just said. You can make a single thing recognize a site with high frequency, high affinity. The problem is that since DNA looks, there's all this DNA in the cell, you have a binding to non-specific sites. And it turns out that for the most part, if the binding of something gets tight enough to a specific site, it gets tight enough to a non-specific site, still down by 10 to the fourth or something, but there's so many non-specific sites that you have a kinetic problem. The thing never gets off the non-specific sites to get onto the specific one. Now, you can always somehow, and in fact, there is one guy who does pretty well on his own, the TET repressor. But in general, what you find is that specificity is determined by proteins that are binding cooperatively. That's almost, there may be no exception to that in higher eukaryotes.
This is true for regulation, but for example, restriction and so
on. That's right. You're absolutely right. That's the example which shows you that it can be done. Yes. Restriction enzymes do not, that's absolutely right.
One thing we heard yesterday was that...
That's probably all baloney, but anyway. That's probably all baloney, so you don't have to worry about it. But anyway. See, I know Brent better than you guys, you know. You know where he came from.
for finding pairs of proteins bound tightly, and that there were examples where each pair of proteins would bind relatively loosely, and yet the binding is still important. And this is an example of that?
Yes.
And
yes.
And we thought this is a three-body interaction.
Yes. That's right.
Together, and you've got to add enhanced energy applied.
That's absolutely right.
There's more than the sum of the pair.
Absolutely.
And
you have.
This is basically a statement that three-body interactions are important.
Yes, and sometimes many more than three, yes.
And in this case, it's three-body interactions involving DNA and two other
bodies. Yes. In fact, there are the best-studied cases in bacteria. You see, look, if we go back, let's just look at this example of gene activation. If you take a standard activator called CAP and you ask for its interaction with polymerase in the absence of DNA, it's never been detected.
Okay.
You can do it. Pardon? Yeah, yeah. I'm sure if you guys put your mind to it, you could detect it. But right. Absolutely. Absolutely. That's right. Yeah. And you can see it actually with non-specific DNA. But But it's so weak that you just don't, so far no one's ever reliably seen it off the DNA.
So our example yesterday was scaffold proteins, and the example today is actually the DNA.
Yep.
The DNA is acting as a scaffold, you said.
Yep.
Okay.
Yes.
Yesterday, phosphorylation involved.
Yeah, we'll get to that. We'll get to how phosphorylation fits into this. It's all the same problem, but yes. That makes no sense. The path, only Maxwell's demon can tell you the path. I mean, there's no right. It's a question of thermodynamics. So
you're still saying you're being in fluctuation.
Oh, everything's in fluctuation. Sure, the Greeks taught us that. Things are coming on and off. Yeah, but
you're being fluctuation.
Well, all we mean is that that if you take a snapshot every billionth of a second, you're much more apt to find them bound when they're together than when they're not. That doesn't mean they don't come on and off, it's just that the rates, yeah.
So then you take the solution of polymerase with activator, and you look for bound pairs, you're not seeing.
Okay, let's just be careful. I've talked about bacteria, so now let's just make this clear. The activators in bacteria, because typically you use only one, or else I can show you two signals to work on a gene, you typically use just one activator. So, and because, you always have to be careful, because bacteria show us the platonic ideal to which biological systems want to get, right? Because they're so highly evolved. So in the bacteria case, you use the fact that they're sitting right next to each other, so that you need a very weak, you can put it this way, you've already solved the entropic problem and so on and so forth once they're right. So, you're right. Now, when we get to higher organisms, that's not true. The activators work from distances. And there, the activating regions you do see interactions with the machinery off the DNA, right? So the three-body problem here, so look, it might be very hard, we're talking about various things here. It might be very hard to see these interactions off the DNA, because these, wherever you have things binding close, the energy you need to get the thing to go is very, very weak. So right? But now if we ask about the activating region that's stuck on this thing, that's interacting with the polymerase or whatever it's interacting with, that you can see off the DNA. Because that has to happen from a distance, the DNA bends, and so it has to have something like a 10 to the minus 7th binding constant if you have to take a...
So each one of these has activating region, like a
bicycle? Yes, I think so. Yes. Well, I think so. Is that right? I think so. I think so. Yeah.
How do you know if this is a nanomachine? How strong is the average?
Ah, well, that's... How do we know it's not something else? Well, first of all, we would have to go through the whole song and dance about how we know activation works in the first place, which I'll give you maybe a flavor for if you're up for it, but it's okay. But in this particular case, there are these beautiful experiments in vitro which show that when these three things are present at the right concentration, they bind cooperatively, they then recruit the machinery. You can reconstruct this. If you knock out a site, it you know, you get an all or none effect. There's some question whether you get an all or none effect even in transients. You know what I mean by that? Transient transfections, where you just take cells and add DNA and then add the proteins. You can see the thing forming on those where you have many copies of the gene. I don't think the evidence is as complete as it is for some of the bacterial cases, but it's pretty good. Sorry? Oh, yeah. Maniatis is, you look up Maniatis and Thanos and those guys.
But having them bind in vitro doesn't still bind in vivo, or they could be distracted by other pseudoscience.
How should I put this? Now you can do these experiments called CHIP experiments, chromosome immune precipitate, where you can actually ask what protein is bound under any given set of circumstances. And it's... I mean, don't forget, ultimately all you have are arguments. There's no such thing as a proof. I mean, look at how the physicists change their mind every 10 minutes about it. Yeah. Well, well, I think Eric will tell you the number is 4.3, something. But these effects, these cooperative effects can really, dare I mention this, there is a thing in yeast, and it's and actually, it may be extremely important as a general way of thinking about something very important to life. Let me just tell you. In yeast, all I forget what percentage, but a very large percentage of the DNA is involved in nice, healthy genes, okay? Drosophila, it's maybe 50% or whatever the number is. Humans, as you may know, only 5% of the DNA is good stuff. The rest of it is parasites. And there's a big huff and a puff to get rid of. In fact, there's a whole theory that says that the only reason sex is selected for in higher organisms is to keep one step ahead of the parasites. This is one of these arguments that, you know, if you think physicists are bad, listen to the evolutionists. You never, because they can prove almost nothing can exist. But anyway, so that's, as far as I know, that's all. So, so there may have to be ways of cooperatively turning off large numbers of genes. So now let's just go back to yeast. At yeast, there are, or to keep them quiet, so they don't cause trouble like these parasites. So at the ends of chromosomes of yeast, there are these so-called telomeres. And it turns out that there are, if you put a gene into it near a telomere, it tends to get silenced. Dear, this is going to be a slightly, so let's not worry about the details, but the point is that the current view is that there are several regions in the yeast chromosome where they probably all come together and make a highly cooperative thing involving actually quite a number of proteins. 4, 5, 6, 7, which then make these special structures. And in fact, an added kick in this, which I've only just realized, is that the cooperativity can be helped in a different way. If you take a protein and attach it to the DNA and you move it to a certain part of the cell, say the membrane, now you take another guy over here and you move it to the membrane, they're going to now be closer to each other and able to interact better. Right? So in other words, you can increase cooperativity by just moving things to a certain spot, even though all they're doing is just cooperative interactions. It's something like taking two A and B. When they're very far apart, they're not going to work. Proteins aren't going to bind cooperatively because of the entropic problem. You move the sites closer, they're going to... Well, another way to do it would be to have A and B and just move their sites up. Right? Yeah. Well, I'm just hesitating a little because I think a good number is three. Maybe Eric will tell you four. He thinks, I don't know, for numbers of signals you have to integrate, but there may be a lot of other guys around who are there anyway, who are constitutively there. So I'm not, you see what I mean? But I think the number, as far as I know, in the best studied cases, the numbers are. Actually, you know, in the Eve enhancer, okay, good, because we have only gotten to slide one, which is good. All right, so. I'm worried about this. I'd like you to get the big picture with as few details as possible. So I'm just not quite sure. First of all, how long? Should we try to stop at 12 or?
15.
All right. Let's see. How can I?
There's a discussion later in the afternoon.
Well, okay. Let me just I want you to get the very big picture, and then you can... So this way of doing things, this crude way of doing things, has the reason God used it is because it's evolvable. Now, I haven't told you, but if we had time, I would make the argument that for every gene that's known about in higher eukaryotes, even lower eukaryotes, from yeast up, they work by this mechanism, not by the other mechanism, the other two fancy mechanisms. Why? Because this mechanism is what I call highly evolvable. Very dangerous word. No evolutionists here? No. Evolvable doesn't mean, you see, what they try to intimidate you, and they say you can't use that word because evolution can't select for what's going to happen in the future. Well, of course not, dummies. The point is that we evolved, and the system that lent itself to that evolution is the one that was used. So evolution used the one that was most susceptible to being, to having multiple inputs, making things dependent on multiple signals, so you could use a small number of regulators and a small number of genes. Right? If you'd done it in a fancier way, and this is actually a subject I keep running into trouble on, and I may have said this to you before, I don't know if there's some fancy design or engineering theory that says that there's another way to do it. See, I look at the world, and if I were to go through all this, I would say, well, it looks incredibly crude to me and slipshod. I mean, first of all, let me just make this point. You can obviously, if you do things this way, you can now, for example, add repressors that bind specifically, and now you have another form of control over the gene. Or, as we've already discussed, but we haven't said this, you can just take a DNA binding domain and stick it right on the polymerase, and now at certain genes, since it's only a question of energy, those genes will be transcribed at a high level. Or, as we've said, you can have multiple activators that work on the gene. All of this means that if you can somehow... The system is evolvable in the following sense. Here are the lac genes of E. coli. So now imagine that the world started with no regulators. These are the two regulators. Well, with a certain frequency, the polymerase will bind to the gene and make beta-galactosidase. So the thing will live in the presence of lactose. Now, it's not the world's most efficient system, but it's fine. So now the first thing you do is say you add a repressor. The repressor binds the DNA only in the absence of lactose. So now the gene will be off unless lactose is present. Now you can add another regulator, an activator, which says that, well, if lactose is present, the thing still won't work very well if glucose is present, because glucose is a better carbon source. So this thing binds to DNA only in the absence of glucose. Right? So if you were, my general point, talking about kinases, about things and so on and so forth, is that if you were to design highly specific enzymes, let's say one polymerase per gene, there is this interesting design problem whether you could do that and what that would mean. But whatever else you say, and I don't know how to think about that, but what is clear is that if you did that, it wouldn't be evolvable. That is to say, once you started with polymerase on a gene, let's say on the lac genes, and it responded allosterically to glucose and galactose or lactose and so on, you'd now have to start all over again for the next gene and start all over again. This way, you have a polymerase that you use at almost all the genes. You're done. And you can add new genes and you can add new regulators. This regulator works at a lot of genes, actually, to signal whether glucose is present. This thing, the lac repressor, only works at the lac genes because it's only concerned. Okay? So... So now, because somebody asked, how do you know this is true? Well, this is a real huff and a puff, and that's why I'm writing this book. But let me just give you a very quick hint of a few things you can do, because... So if the way things work... So how do you know this is true in yeast, for example? Well, if an activator is just a piece of glue that brings in the machinery, and the DNA binding part is giving the specificity, then any protein-protein interaction should suffice. Any of many protein-protein interactions should suffice, provided the thing is tethered to DNA to activate a gene. That's called an activator bypass. In other words, there's nothing special about this activating region. It's just a bit of glue. And in fact, there are many experiments. We first did this, but it doesn't matter. Anyway, many experiments now done in bacteria, for example, where here's the polymerase drawn in a fancier way, and you cut off part of the polymerase and you put some yellow stuff, and that yellow stuff interacts with this green stuff, and you put the green stuff, you attach it to a protein, in this case lambda repressor, binding quite a distance from the gene, and this interaction, which ordinarily occurs only in yeast, will now quote-unquote activate the gene in E. coli. And there are similar experiments done in yeast. So this is to me, extremely important conceptual thing that you assume, because you call something an activator, there's a tendency to assume that it's doing something special, is implied by the word activation. But in fact, what the bypass experiments show, of which there are many kinds, and many kinds in many different systems, is that if you just bring together the two things by any mechanism, you will have the same effect. Which is then consistent with a huge amount of other evidence that in fact, that's all an activator is doing. And so in particular, for example, let's just skip all this junk. These activating regions, what are they like? Well, in fact, they're if you know what signal sequences are, they're something like signal sequences. They're typically acidic. You can make them by random synthesis. You can make them by the thousands. They don't look exactly like one another, but they're sort of related. It's blah, blah, blah. They can be as short as 8 amino acids. There are a lot of things that work as activating regions. And the reason is that they just have to touch somewhere to get the thing to work. There are many potential targets, as I've implied. Let's just skip all that. Now, there's a question that you asked. This is an extremely important point. One of the reasons, actually, I believed all this 10 years ago, is that if you take an activator and you cut off its DNA binding domain, what happens if you express the activating region at a high concentration? The answer is, one, it cannot activate, because activation is simply recruitment. So it must be bound to DNA to activate. Now, if you remember back from that case, let's see, do I have it here? Yes. Remember this case where the thing is stuck on the gene and the thing binds next to the gene and then does a particular allosteric effect? If you express this activating region, which is quite different, this is quite a specialized machinery, at high concentration, it turns on all those genes, right? Because it's just going and goosing each one. The specificity, again, depends on this thing being low enough so that it only works where it's bound. Now, there's a further point, and that is, on this matter, let's just go back. Not only must activators be bound to DNA to work, but if you overexpress the activating region by itself, it will tend to do something we call squelch. That is to say, it will cover up all the sites on the machinery so that now another activator can't work. So in other words, an activator that's not bound to DNA not only does not activate, at a high enough concentration, it will inhibit. There's nothing fancy about this idea. It's just tinker toys. But is it clear what I'm saying? And in fact, that's the result that you always see in higher organisms. If you overexpress an activating region unattached to DNA, you never activate a gene, no exception that we know of. You only inhibit in general, which right away tells you that first model can't hold. That's one of the ways we know, okay?
These three models you were giving, you're saying third one is most of the time?
The third one, those are three that are found in bacteria. Bacteria show us everything. The third is, so far as we know, the only one found in, so, or let me put it the other way around. All the cases we know about in higher organisms involve just the third. And I claim that's, of course, there may, you know, ultimately be special cases and exceptions. But that third one, the crudest one, is the one that lends itself to signal integration by these various ways we've been talking about. That's why it's been used. Okay? And now you can see, by the way, another reason that the concentration of activators has to be kept low in the nucleus. Because if there are a lot of activating regions around the nucleus, they're just going to squelch everything by binding to the machinery. So instead, you keep them out in the cytoplasm, and you keep destroying them, and so on and so forth. And by the way, this is the basis of the two hybrid. Roger, did you tell them about the two hybrid system?
Alluded.
So do you know about the two hybrid system? No? Two hybrid yeast system? So what you have is, you have a DNA binding domain stuck to protein A. Now you want to know what is, and not, A is not an activating, you make a hybrid. Now you want to know what does A interact with? Pardon? Did I? I don't think so. Stop me when I come to it. No. Can you make this go up? Yeah, but that's confusing. Oh, that's right. They might be, but that's not quite what we want to talk about. Okay, so you take a DNA binding domain, for example, from the famous activator Gal4. Gal4 is the one that we study in that works in yeast, but it doesn't matter. It's just a DNA binding domain. Now you fuse that, you take off its activating region, and you fuse it to protein A.
This is what we heard about yesterday.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah.
This is what you heard about yesterday. So, the two hybrid system. And the reason it's called two hybrids is that you have a hybrid protein here. Now you want to know who does it interact with. So you make a library of guys who include, for example, protein B stuck on an activating region. Now only if A and B interact, you turn the gene on. Now why is that? That's because these things are working by recruitment. So activating regions floating around don't do anything. That's why the young have an easier time listening to me than the old, because they grew up doing the two hybrids screens in high school. So if I tell them, well, this thing has to, they go, okay, any dummy knows that, because the basis of the world is the two hybrid system. Right? Do you see what I mean? Okay. So now, let me see if there are any other combinations of activators work synergistically. We discussed that. Here was that case I was telling you about, the interferon thing, which is just a colorful depiction of what I've already told you. Let me just tell you one thing about lambda, because actually I didn't realize this until not so long ago. So for those of you who know, this is what the creationists like to call a thing of great beauty. And so here you have lambda repressor monomers. The lambda repressor gene is here. So the monomers are made, the thing dimerizes. The dimers interact cooperatively to bind to sites 1 and 2. This thing interacts with polymerase, binding cooperatively with that, so that repressor turns on transcription of its own gene in a highly cooperative way, something like the fourth power of the monomer concentration, just to speak roughly. If the repressor concentration gets too high, it binds to this weak site 3, and that's an example of why you have to keep, of how you keep the concentration low, so that the whole thing depends on these interactions. So that means that this is part of the explanation for why, as you begin to inactivate repressor, when you irradiate the cells, there's a steep function where suddenly, bang, it switches. You've converted a linear to a digital or something. That's roughly the idea. Analog to a... Okay. So now what's amusing here is that you have three different kinds of protein-protein interaction. The dimerization, the interaction between dimers, and the interaction between repressor and polymerase. And all three of those guys can be replaced by other interactions. So in other words, you can take some other gizmos here and get this effect. In other words, what has happened, and all that induction is, induction means the turning on of the in this very steep way, turns out to be that when you radiate cells, you cleave this molecule so that the carboxyl domain, the top part of the dumbbell, gets separated from the bottom part. Now notice that the bottom part is perfectly capable of binding DNA and interacting with polymerase. But you get this induction, this striking induction, simply because you've eliminated the cooperativity function. The cooperativity function being due to these simple interactions of the carboxyl domains. So in other words, what looks like a very specialized, highly fancy business is really just taking a very simple system. Now we simply add some glue to make two monomers come together, not an all or none fashion, but an equilibrium. Now we add another bit of glue so that they interact with each other to bind cooperatively, and now you've converted this sort of poopy system into this very sophisticated system, but it's just based on adding these very simple functions in the form of a carboxyl domain, as it turns out, attached to the domain that contains all the action, the DNA binding and the... Is that clear? So again, this whole thing would works just at the right concentration range. Now let me just say, when you get to higher organisms, not only is the logic more complicated in the sense that you have multiple signals inputting into a gene, the machinery is much more complicated. So the DNA comes wrapped in these things called nucleosomes, you know about those? And there are all these, and there are enzymatic functions that work on the nucleosomes. There are some that acetylate the histones, there are some that deacetylate the histones. There are now guys who methylate and who do this and who do that. And so this is a whole long and not entirely clear thing. But the point I want to make is that, well, in case you don't know this, if you take Gal4, the activator that works in yeast, now you go to higher organisms. In higher organisms, if you take Gal4 and put binding sites for Gal4 in front of a gene, it works. Works perfectly well. So everything we figured out from yeast obviously applies to higher organisms. And without going through the whole thing, because this really gets grim, it really actually looks like what these activating regions, these acidic regions do, is just recruit whatever is necessary. So you recruit these things that acetylate the nucleosomes, and that then aids binding of the next big complex, which also is touched by the activator, and so on and so forth. And in fact, this gets to what I call the 10% rule. So there's this huge machinery, and it turns out that there are some guys here, like the polymerase itself, and a couple of guys, like TBP, it's called, and a couple of these proteins that are absolutely required. You knock them out, all transcription stops. For about all, as far as we know, for the other 40 or 50 proteins, you knock any one out, and about 10% of the genes increase, and about 10% of the genes decrease their transcription. Cell is viable, and it goes on. Life goes on. It's amazing how much stuff is there that seems to work on the margin. And so I don't know what to make of that, but how much of these huge complexes, there are some of these complexes you can take major components out of and the complexes still remain. It's all as though it's as though it evolved. It seems to always be the case that you get the elementary thing works, and now you add something else, it works a little better, something else, and it works on certain genes, and certain so on and so forth. You get the feeling that the system is sort of cobbled together, as opposed to being something that, whether that inspires you to do calculations or...
So the 10% rule was saying...
10% rule is that almost anything you do in the form of mutations to knock out a function has about a 10% effect.
in fitness or in what?
Well, no, really just asking, you can now just ask the transcription of, if you do a chip experiment and say you've got, what happens to the genes? About 10% go up, 10% go down noticeably, and about 80% don't seem to care. And the cells get sicker, but they all live. There are a few mutations that are lethal, few things you've got to have. But surprising how... Yeah?
I vaguely remember that there was an assertion that bacteria were more fine-tuned and more sensitive, and the higher organisms were
yes.
More redundant.
Yeah, you can't... Well, I think so. Let's see. There is actually a subunit polymerase no one talks about that seems to have no function called omega. But if you take any of the polymerase subunits and you mutate them in bacteria, you certainly are lethal. And there aren't any other things. There are the activators and the repressors. Now, most of those, in fact, you can mutate. Regulation, yeah. I mean, regulation, I'm beginning to think, is all an epiphenomenon. What? No. We have to distinguish two things. You would certainly expect that if you knocked out, for example, the LAC repressor, which has a very specialized role, it would have no effect. It would have a fitness effect, but no drastic effect. We're talking now about the machinery itself, not the regulators. In the higher organisms, there are lots of parts of the machinery, which is like 50 proteins, some of which acetylate, some of which deacetylate, some of which... And those you can seem to fool with a lot, okay? And by the way, there's another... Before we get on to the kinases and the phosphatases, just notice that there's a... These enzymes that work, say, to acetylate nucleosomes, which to a first approximation helps transcription, and there are mutations, there are complexes that deacetylate histones, which to first approximation have the opposite effect, they work as part of the background, and they also work by being recruited. So you have, right? And you can imagine, and in fact it may turn out to be, this is the thing that's so infuriating about biology, it could be something as silly as an increase in activity of a senacetylase by a factor of 3 or 4 or 5, or in a deacetylase, say, that can affect whole ranges of genes. Because, just getting back to this other point, gene activation is a quantitative thing. There's no such thing as switching a gene on and off. Right? Depending on how strong the activating region is, depending on how strong it binds to DNA, all this stuff, depending on a lot of things, the gene will be on to some level or to a lower level or whatever.
Well, this might be something you mentioned, Mark, but you're touching on something a point I didn't make yesterday. It's that in higher eukaryotes and in biology going forward, so many of the phenomena we care about will not necessarily be due to Thomas Hunt Morgan type genes that that are essential to the process of life.
Yes, exactly.
One of the processes you care about will be affected by the products cause quantitative changes in small ones. 20th century genetics get to the important genes that are ill-equipped to deal with these. There's some, this is going to be a growth area, I think, methodologically, in terms of how you think about, and also how you think about it. And one thing I mentioned, I don't know if you paid attention to this, the experiment by Victoria Smith originally in Boston trials, which allowed you to quantify the contribution of an individual gene to the population of the study of business under any given circumstances. You can now begin to see your ways to at least get hold of it. But how you think
about it. Yeah. Well, it could even be worse than that in the sense that remember I told you about this telomere effect, where genes get turned off, so to speak, if they're right in this complex structure? Well, it turns out that if you look, I know it's one of the problems nowadays is email. So you can email, and every time you write a fact, you know, you think, is that true? So you write 10 people, and of course, 5 say it's true and 5 say it's false. But, and you never can figure it. But a lot of it is because there are, it's beginning to sound like Lewontin. A lot of it is because there are fluctuations that between cell to cell and between strain to strain. So, for example, how big of an effect is there at the telomere? Well, I have the world's authority telling me it's never more than 3%. I've got another world authority telling me it's 90%. Well, they're using different strains, and it, evidently it has to do with the fluctuation in the, since this is a highly cooperative effect at the telomere, a 2 or 3-fold fluctuation in the expression of one of these components gives you huge effects, right? And the reason I mention that is that now you may know the Guaranty thing. There's this whole theory of aging, which says that the kind of proteins that are responsible for this silencing are precisely the ones that tend to get lost as you age. And in fact, they've just published a paper showing that if you squirt one of these genes into a worm, you can make the worm live 3 times as long. I mean, it's a completely idiotic thing. You're talking about an auxiliary function whose concentration, you know, can be varying over a course of whatever. And it just may be that you could even imagine that if the cell just happens to have a fluctuation and it loses one of these things, some gene gets on and then turns on and then becomes self-perpetuating in some way, and now you can't go back, and now you do it. So, and aging could turn out to be just the gradual loss of these things that has nothing to do with mutation, it has nothing to do with, you see what I mean? It just could have to do with fluctuations of these background activities. Because very small, keep coming back to this point, very small effects on actual physical levels of transcription can have huge biological effects. You can make a yeast dependent on uracil or not dependent on uracil by an incredibly small change in the level of transcription. We're talking less than kilocalories here now. You know. That's really, the more one always tries to avoid thinking about this because it really makes life a mess, right? But I think now that I'm in the state of benign disillusionment, everything strikes me as accidental and subject to these kinds of things. There is nothing built in about gene regulation. It's not like sticking a key into a car. It's just making some dumb reaction, smart reaction actually, but making it happen more or less. And it's just subject to all these inputs. You see what I mean? So now I'm going to... This way of thinking, it seems to me, is very general, and it gets back to this issue of the basis of specificity of enzymes. So let me just give you a couple of examples. Fortunately, we know less about these, so we don't have so many arguments. So are you familiar with this? This is the so-called ubiquinating machinery. What happens is there's something called an E1 ligase, an E2 ligase, and inexplicably, an E3 ligase. And what happens is that a protein coming into this machinery has these things called ubiquinating gizmos stuck on them, ubiquitin stuck on them. That means they immediately go to something called a proteasome and get degraded. Now, this is a very complicated enzyme, right? And if for some reason the ubiquitin first attaches here and then it gets transferred to here. Now, this thing is called, there are several of these kinds of guys and cells. This thing's called an F-box that works on this. The F-box has a characteristic sequence that always interacts with the enzyme, and then another sequence that interacts with a particular protein. There are like 100 F-box proteins, say in yeast, or some number. In this case, the interaction only occurs when this thing, SYK1P, gets phosphorylated. So it gets recognized by this guy. Now, this brings it to the ubiquinating machinery, and this thing gets ubiquinated. But what's amusing is that an experiment done by Zhengbao Pu, I think is his name, if you cut off this part of the F-box protein and you substitute a sequence that's known to interact with a protein called RB, which is a mammalian protein, but which is perfectly stable in yeast, now this thing very efficiently causes the ubiquination and degradation of that, because it then goes to the proteasome. So in other words, this to me is a perfect way of thinking about gene regulation. You have a very complex enzyme, and you have these special things that used to be called activators, but what they are locators. And you can do a bypass experiment where you cut this off, attach it to something else, and whatever it brings to that enzyme will work. In other words, the enzyme has many substrates. In fact, it has as many substrates probably as there are proteins in the cell. And where it works is determined by the locator. So instead of having a ubiquinating machine for each enzyme, for each protein, sorry, you have one machine, just like RNA polymerase, but then a lot of adapters or locators that just bring in the proteins to get ubiquinated. You see what I mean? Here's another example. There are these, there are kinases called cyclin-dependent kinases. These run the cell cycle. So in yeast, in fact, there's one kinase, cyclin-dependent kinase. What happens is that at various stages of the cell cycle, different cyclins appear and then get degraded and appear. The cyclin appears, and it does two things. One is it activates the enzyme. Now, I should say, kinases are really dangerous. So the cell has to go to great lengths, and we'll see why in a second if I think. See, if polymerase transcribes the wrong gene occasionally, it doesn't matter. But kinases are so nonspecific that that nature goes to an extra step to make sure that they only are active when they're supposed to work. So they're held in an inactive conformation. So all the cyclins have the same surface, interacts with the kinase, and makes it active. But now, where does it go? And the answer is that it goes to the designated substrate because of a little patch on the cyclin, a locator patch. If you knock out that locator patch, it doesn't go there. If you add a heterologous sequence elsewhere on the cyclin, in fact, it's the same sequence as in the previous experiment, now it interacts with a different part of this protein, but promotes the same reaction, the same complicated reaction. In other words, the cyclins do two things. They activate the enzyme, but they also locate the enzyme. It's the same story. You have an enzyme with an active site that has lots of possible substrates. Which substrate it works on depends on the glue that's either provided by an adapter or that's stuck elsewhere on the protein. That's the general rule of life. Here's another example, one of my favorites actually, because this seems to be so counterintuitive that it works this way. It turns out that the HIV virus, when its main promoter starts reading RNA, the RNA goes a little way and stops, and it makes this complicated tertiary structure. The thing makes a protein called TAT, which binds to the RNA and causes transcription to continue. So there were years of huffing and puffing about that, exactly how the TAT interacts with the RNA and how does it do this. Then it was discovered that the TAT evidently recruits another cyclin-dependent kinase that phosphorylates the tail of the part of the polymerase to help it transcribe. So now, if we just skip right over to here, the point is that you can replace that RNA sequence that's recognized by TAT by a different one that's recognized by a totally different RNA binding protein, fuse the RNA binding protein to the cyclin, and this works perfectly well. So you'll notice this is not just an activating region bypass. Here you've gotten rid of the activator altogether. There is no more TAT. All TAT is doing is locating where the cyclin-dependent kinase is going to work. This is just the same story. The details of protein-RNA interaction are no more interesting than the details of protein-DNA interaction. It's just a locator function, because the thing that's doing the... Right.
Well, back to your previous slide, wouldn't you have guessed that the position that it's brought...
You might have.
...the enzyme would make a difference?
You might have, but it doesn't.
Is that a general rule of thumb?
Well, it's a very interesting point, that sometimes you would guess that sometimes the stereochemistry of the interaction would be important, and sometimes it, and sometimes it is in the transcriptional bypasses, but not enough bypasses have been done in these other cases to know. And very often it just doesn't matter. These kinds of experiments, by the way, are never published in the proper literature because they're considered uninteresting. See, it's just a frame of mind. Actually, a physicist would do this kind of experiment because this kind of experiment gets at the heart of the basis of specificity. But the people, the mafia who run the molecular biology world say, well, it's not complicated enough and it's not interesting enough because all you're saying is that where the thing goes determines what it does. That's not very interesting. But if you say, but that's the basis of enzyme specificity, isn't that important? Well, so all these papers are published in out-of-the-way places. Even though to me they're the ones, you know, it's like being a French deconstructionist. It's what they don't tell you that's interesting, right? Now, here's one of my favorite examples. This is a signal transduction pathway. So what happens is this thing called a cytokine binds, these two chains come together. There are some associated kinases called Jak kinases, which kinase these red gizmos. Now, the red gizmos then attract a protein called a STAT, which is a transcriptional activator. By virtue of being attracted there, the Jak now phosphorylates the STAT, and the thing once phosphorylated goes to the nucleus and activates transcription with other guys working cooperatively. Now, why is this example so interesting? First of all, what is the role of the cytokine? Well, it's just to bring these two chains together. If you just overexpress the two chains, it all works without the cytokine. So that's your first activator bypass experiment. The ligand is only bringing two things together. It's a concentration-dependent effect. If you overexpress receptors, you turn on the system. Another example of where the thing depends on a concentration effect. Now, the Jak kinases. It turns out there are a lot of these Jak kinases associated with various receptors, but they're completely interchangeable. It's not clear why there are different ones. The most interesting thing is, though, that it reveals, you see, by putting a phosphate here, the SH2 group, did you talk about SH2s? Well, SH2 is a typical domain that binds phosphorylated residues. That brings STAT-A into the vicinity of the Jak kinase, which then phosphorylates it. But here's the wonderful thing. If you look at another one of these, where it's a yellow guy who gets phosphorylated with a different kinase, now STAT-B comes along and binds to that with a different SH2 group, it gets phosphorylated, so now you turn on a different set of genes. But the point is that the Jaks are indiscriminate. They don't care whether it's STAT-A or STAT-B that's present. They'll kinase it. In other words, the specificity of the kinase is determined by its location. And all SH2, so here's, and the proof of that is, if you swap the yellow guy for the red guy, you swap the effects, the specificity. If you swap the SH2 here with this SH2, you swap the specificity. So now here comes the big generalization that...
Is it always the same SH2 binding to anything?
No, they're different SH2s. Right. Actually, okay, let me get back to that in just one second, because that's an important point. But now here's the big thing. The big here's it explains the whole world. DNA binding domains, so I don't know if you read any of the signal transduction literature, but there are zillions and zillions of these domains called SH2, SH3, PDZ, PLFs, Ws, which are responsible for, which recognize particular gizmos. The SH2s recognize phosphorylated guys. The SH3s recognize unphosphorylated guys. The point is that these domains serve the same function as DNA binding domains. They are simply opposing the enzyme with the substrate so that the proper specificity is imposed. Is that clear? So in other words, where you're going to activate, which gene you activate, just depends on the nature, on where your DNA, what your DNA binding domain is. Which protein the JAK kinase is going to work on just depends on who's got an SH2 to bring it next to it. In other words, all these enzymes, all these kinases, have many possible substrates. Substrate choice is determined by a DNA, by a protein location address, just like, you see? In other words, nature's scheme is to make relatively non-specific enzymes and then impose specificity by these locational properties. And, just to answer your question, although they don't like to talk about it, it's going to turn out that these SH2s indeed are not specific enough to work on their own, and that there will be cooperativity just like there is with DNA binding domains. So, for example, someone recently did a... again, they couldn't get this published anywhere. They did a wonderful thing. They did a sequencer. It got published in an obscure place. And if you look for SH2 recognition sites in all known proteins, you find zillions of them, but very few are biologically relevant where they could check. Where you look for two or more, or SH2 in combination with SH3, then you start to get real ones. So here there is almost certainly more going on than just this, but you can in some cases actually swap the specificity by, but you need, right? That's absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Right. But the all that the ligand is doing is bringing two chains together. That's right. But only because this binding site recognizes A, this binding site recognizes B. There's no specificity to the kinase. Right? And then the kinase will work either on a red patcher or a yellow patch. There's no specificity. But once it's done that, it brings, right? Do you see what I mean? So that the system, right, I never mean to say there isn't specificity in the system. There must be, there is specificity. But the specificity is determined by these locational patches, not by its specificity in the enzymes. That's why I think what's going to happen, I mean, and I think it's all, it's going to happen that when finally somebody can get a hold of the actual Celera sequence, the new enzymes that are present in the in humans are going to be the old enzymes, just with more locator patches. So you're going to have, you're going to see, the, if you look in nature, it's what it looks like, nobody comments on it, but you have the same old enzyme, kinase or whatever it is, and then you have these things. You have SH2, you have, instead of two or three SH2s, you have SH2, SH3, PML, HMG, all these are just little domains that nature has. That's why there's so many of these domains, like DNA binding domains. There are four or five categories of DNA binding domains. They're these little things that come folded, but which have can be varied along one surface to give you different specificities. So that's what's going to happen with these new so-called new enzymes in humans. It's the way, in fact, they are new enzymes in the sense that they recognize different substrates. But they recognize different substrates not because the active site has been fooled with. That's too hard. They do it the cheap way by adding locational sequences.
Isn't this quite similar to what happens, for example, with proteases, in which the active site actually does the break of the peptide bond stays quite evolutionarily conserved, but you can have different replication sites with different sequences and probably kind of protein and protein and so on. So the principle is profound and actually has been used very early on in evolution.
That may be, yes.
This modular,
you
have two different proteins doing the recognition and the enzymatics.
The two different domains,
Different domains
Yeah, that's a good point. In the protease, I mean, I don't. I should learn more about that. But I think the difference there is, as you just implied, the protease case, you fool with amino acids right around the active site, and in fact, it becomes semantic. What's the active site and what isn't? Whereas in this case, it's just it's absolutely clear, right?
Yeah.
Right. I think that's right.
What is the size of the repertoire of the substrate that SH2S3 can work with? In a sense, a transcription factor recognizing about 10 binding sites, and you know the variability, the total size it can recognize is four letters.
The answer to that is known exactly. They recognize about a 4 or 5 amino acid thing. And whenever an individual SH2 is studied, you find preferences, but nothing very, very striking. That's why it's going to turn out they all work cooperatively. But these domains all have the property that they're folded with their amino and carboxyl ends together so they can just be inserted into a protein like that. And then you have at this side the part that interacts with. So they're beautiful little locational things. And some of them recognize things in the membrane, some recognize this, some recognize that. Yeah.
How many adoptive molecules are there?
God, there are a lot of them. I don't know, but I noticed in that Nature article on the genome there were these guys I'd never heard of before. So new ones are being discovered all the time, but there are a lot of them. Yeah, probably dozens is the answer. Yeah.
Of types.
Of types, yeah. And then each type would have, yeah.
Recognize different.
Yeah.
But then they work in combinations.
Then they work in combinations, yeah. Yeah.
Well, and there's some molecules that are kind of pure play. All they do is loading.
Yeah.
All they are more loads.
There
are others that have nothing about the function ground. So see, you count of all the proteins in the 40,000 that have some locator on them. It might be now.
Yeah. For example, here's one that Roger's talking about. This thing called CRAC is just an SH3 and an SH2, and it works cooperatively binding, recognizing this and this to bring the substrate to the... And if you do an activator bypass by sticking the SH2 onto the thing directly, you don't even need the SH3. So it just shows you that the SH3 is doing a locator effect. I mean, in a way, it's sort of bad news for the genome because you know, you're just not going to know, looking at these things, what their function is. And in fact, there are these wonderful experiments in Drosophila where you can take an activator called glucocorticoid, which affects, you know, wing development, so on and so forth, and another activator, and they have almost no homology. None that you can see other than that they're of a general class. And you swap one for the other, and it works quite well, actually. It's because what they do is so simple. And they can drift and they can, you know. So by looking at these things, you're going to have very little idea. Yeah. That's not going to work. I know what you're... No. I think what you're going to end up saying is that the concentration of proteins in cells is so high that it's hard to believe it works this way.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's a good question. I just know that when... The concentration of proteins in the nucleus in the cell is unbelievably high. Even in the nucleus, the concentration of things is unbelievably high. And yet, there was just a review about this. It's rather astonishing, actually, but when you do a photobleaching experiment, you then find that the protein seems to go by diffusion. It's limited only by diffusion. And it's all really rather mysterious to me. But you should understand, especially because of this problem with the kinases, they go, as I keep saying, they go to great lengths not to work when they shouldn't. So for example, SARC, which causes all kinds of problems when it's got this inhibitory flap that keeps itself, right, and the thing that activates it is when it sees a tyrosine, it opens this flap, so when it uses the flap not only to bind its substrate, but also to relieve the auto-inhibition. And there are just going to be many details like this to get the thing to work. And again, the sort of thing that doesn't get published, but if you, late at night, you ask any signal transduction person, they'll tell you, well, by the way, I overexpressed a kinase in the cell and all the signal transduction pathways got turned on. But you can't publish that because it's an artifact of some sort. As a matter of fact, there's a cryptic article by a man named Perumon in Science that in which he, you see, a lot of people say, well, these signal transduction pathways talk to one another. So then you, well, how do they know that? Well, because you're dealing with, well, we expressed the kinase and now we found this other signal transduction pathway got turned on. So he's pointing out, although it's hard to, I think if he'd said it clearly, they wouldn't have published it. He's pointing out that a lot of this could just be because of these effects. And you get, right? And even, you just take a cell growing in culture. That's already something that's wacko compared with what's in a living organism, right? It's transformed, it's overproducing this, overproducing that. Any sort of statement you make about what the pathways are is, I'm not saying it's wrong, but you have to be very careful. There's a beautiful example. There are these two signal transduction pathways in yeast involving these so-called MAP kinases, and they go down, and then activates this, and this goes in. So now what Fink found was that if you mutate one of these kinases, fine, now this signal transduction pathway only works here, and this one is dead. But if you delete this kinase, now guess what? Now this signal transduction pathway activates over here. It's because by deleting something, since these things only have specificity by which scaffold they're on, it's very easy for the thing apparently activated to hop over to the other guy. I mean, it's when you get into it, it gets more and more complicated. But the point is, it even brings into question how you do traditional genetics in a lot of these cases. If you make deletions, there's a so-called redundancy problem in when people knock out genes in mice, they find it doesn't make much difference. Well, maybe partly for these reasons. Because so much of, right, well, I think you get the rough idea. Let's see, I don't know if I have anything else I want to... I mean, I think you've had enough anyway. Well, yeah, there's more of this stuff, but it's just all more of the same, so... So let me just check on the board and see if I've... small energies, evolvability, signal integration, complexities, accidental, nature of the complexities... Protein-protein promiscuity. I haven't really mentioned that explicitly, but notice that in these sorts of examples where NF-kappa B interacts with these guys, in a different situation it interacts with these guys. So then you say, well, how can... We're used to thinking of protein-protein interactions as being really quite highly defined, and maybe Roger talked about this, I don't know. But this is the only thing in the picture that bothered me for quite a while, but I guess the answer is that it's incredibly easy once you solve the entropy problem and all that junk, and you get things very close to one another, interacting, it's very easy to make the protein so that they can interact with a lot of different partners. I mean, I think that's... In fact, you probably would have to select against it. Who knows, right? So that's... Well, because, all you need is a hydrogen bond. So you've got this huge surface, right? And all you have to do is end up with a hydrogen bond on the plus side. And that's just apparently very easy to do. I mean, only if you really designed it so that they interfered with one another or something, then you just move their sites.
Then they'll all be aggregated.
No. They only aggregate, that's the point. These weak interactions only become relevant when their sites are close.
Yeah, but the concentration protein is pretty high. If everybody sort of interacting with everybody, then non-specific...
No. It's, why do all the activators in E. coli work? They all interact with polymerase. But the interaction only becomes biologically or chemically relevant when their sites are close together. This is a, yeah, this is a profound thing. So you can make very weak interactions biologically meaningful if you put their sites close together. And in fact, there's this amazing thing in that shows you how easy to do this, come to think of it. Okay, so do you know about the Eve gene in Drosophila? Because this is a wonderful example. In general...
Yesterday we called that
even skipped. Okay. So in general, there are two ways to make a gene subject to multiple inputs. I'll call this gene X. So the genes Davidson likes to talk about have associated promoters with like 50 binding sites for things. Now you can turn gene X on at time A by using 1, 3, 7, and 8, say, the protein binds. You turn it on at gene B and it'll use 2, 4, 6, and 9. Okay, but now, the other way to do this, by the way, is to just reiterate X and just use the proper set of binding sites for each one. And sometimes evolution does one, sometimes does another. It's the same thing. But very often, and Eve is the wonderful example, which Roger may have told you about, there are these separate little enhancers upstream, lots of them. And each one binds a set of regulators to turn the gene on at a certain time or in a certain position. So now, what's interesting is that if you compare two different strains of Eve, say, and you ask about this enhancer which causes a certain thing called stripe 2 to form, this thing binds three or four proteins, hunchback and these various Drosophila proteins which are present in the gradient in the fly. The other guy has the same binding sites but in different orders and with different affinities. And if you looked at it, you'd say, well, that's probably not going to work. But you put it in that enhancer into this, from the other strain into this strain, and it works. So in other words, there are lots of ways of... It actually seems to be quite easy to adjust the thing so that you'll make these guys work cooperatively. Even, it's not as though you have to have a very precisely defined set of sites to respond to the same set of proteins. You can adjust the affinities and the positions and blah, blah, blah. Lots of ways for evolution to do it.
The orders
are different, yeah. I forget the exact details, but it's quite a striking fact that shows you how easy it is to